Social justice means applying the law equally to all people. But in practice, that doesn't always happen. I'm John Gonzalez. I'm here at my law partner, Jack DeRora. We practice law. We seek social justice. On this show, we reveal the conflict between the two.
You know, for a while, it was just us in the office over a cup of coffee talking about the news of the day. With social justice issues dominating our culture, our focus became how do we as lawyers make a difference?
And now it's not just us. Today, we have Dr. Bill Lafayette, the owner of Regionomics, to make sense of the minimum wage and other economic issues. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for having me.
Jack, I don't know if I told you this story over the years, but when I was growing up, my mom would tell me this story of working for the Mellon Bank in Denora, Pennsylvania, when she was a girl. Mm-hmm. And she was so proud of the fact that she was making $2.50 an hour, and she worked that job and saved her money. And at some point, I got thought about, I said, Mom, why would you work for such a little amount of money? Like, what is the lesson I'm supposed to learn from that, right? And I was wondering, just thinking about talking to Bill today, I wonder if there was a minimum wage back then and, you know, what it might have been. So this is,
well, I can beat your mother's low wage. My first job at the College of Steubenville cutting grass, it was either $1.40 or $1.60 an hour, and I was delighted to get it. And also bear in mind, a Hershey bar back then cost about 10 cents. So let's put that in perspective.
Sure.
Well, so what we find is that the government has decided that there should be at least a minimum wage for certain workers. My impression is, and I don't know if I've had a job at minimum wage ever, but my impression is that those workers are in the lower economic portion of our society. Is that right, Bill?
That is entirely right. Minimum wage is entirely inadequate to meet what most people need to live on.
My daughter just opened a pizza restaurant in Delaware, Ohio, and she has been in the restaurant business for years and years, her and her fiance, and they raised everybody's salaries. They bought an existing place, and just to give them more money and pay a little bit better than, you know, the other service types of jobs. But those are the workers we're looking at, right? The people that are making the pizzas or the hamburgers or waiting on tables. What is Ohio's minimum wage now?
$10.45 an hour.
Okay. I thought I read somewhere where that's a constitutional benefit, if I can say that.
Yeah, well, the minimum wage in Ohio goes back to 1971, and it's more recently been indexed to inflation. So every year it goes up based on inflation, which is a whole lot more actually than the federal minimum wage. Federal minimum wage is $7.25, and it's been that since 2009.
What is the main argument, and I'm assuming it's by businesses, against paying a minimum wage?
That it will hamper their profits, that it will lead to unemployment, that it's just not not conducive to hiring more people.
What gets me frosted about this argument and what led us to inviting Bill was what I read a few weeks back when Bernie Moreno, Frank LaRose, and Matt Dolan were running in the primary. And at least two of them, Dolan and Moreno, said, wow, the minimum wage was never designed to be a living wage. Can't raise it. It has to be determined by market forces. And what always bothers me about those comments is they're always made by people who are doing well financially. And there just seems to be something wrong about people at the top talking about what people at the lower end of the economic ladder should be doing.
I'm not entirely sure how conversant people at the top are with the struggles of people who are working for minimum wage, putting together two and three jobs just to keep a roof over their heads.
Yeah, you wonder how, even with the minimum wage, people can have enough to afford their rent, afford their groceries, and, you know, Lord bless them if they have children that, you know, with their needs. The minimum wage is not a lot of money. Is there any research that employers that are not compelled to provide a minimum wage actually pay more?
They pay whatever the market requires them to pay. And actually, when you look at the minimum wage relative to wages in Central Ohio, fewer than 10% of all jobs pay the minimum wage. The rest pay more.
And I think there's some qualification on the business that that the law covers, right? Is there a certain amount of gross or net revenue? How's that work?
It's in Ohio, the minimum wage applies to employers with gross revenues of $385,000 or more.
It doesn't seem like a lot.
It's not really, no. If you're not making $385,000, you're subject to that much lower federal minimum wage.
We hear, in fact, you've said it, Bill, that, you know, the market determines what wage is paid. Well, okay, I understand what that means, but that's a market forces in terms of employment at that level seems to me to be somewhat odd. Here's what I mean. If you look at Walmart with, I don't know, a million employees, something huge, pays $17 or $18 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having a hard time equating market forces when it comes to income along the same lines that we speak about market forces when it comes to buying a laptop. I mean, you go shop for a laptop, you find a better price. You don't seem to have as much mobility or choices when it comes to a job at that level. Help me, what am I missing here?
Well, there are certainly a lot of employers, whether they're retailers or warehouses or healthcare that are competing for that same minimally skilled worker. And so it's not just going down the street to Target. It's maybe going to a warehouse or going to a hospital. A curious thing happened during the early days of the pandemic. Retailers tended to, restaurants especially, tended to shut down. They had to shut down. And when they were able to reopen legally, they couldn't find workers. And my suspicion is that the people who had been waiting tables went down to Rickenbacker and applied for jobs at the warehouses, and the warehouses were going great guns because everybody was ordering stuff through the internet. And so they probably found a better standard of living, certainly more regular income. They didn't have to rely on tips anymore. And so once you're there, you may not go back.
I have a client that utilizes hundreds of temp workers.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem week in and week out for the company is finding people that want to work.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't see the temp services offering more money mm-hmm. as far as the wage. I mean, the wages are... if I recall right, $14 to $16 an hour. So more than the minimum wage, but still for this type of factory work, which is a fairly, you know, fairly rough job, just doesn't seem to me to be a lot of incentive to take that job for that money. There's got to be other jobs out there that you don't have to work as hard.
I get bothered by the fact that you see what the cost to live is, let's say, in Franklin County.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a couple different numbers, depending on what scale you use. One said $50,000, and then there's a professor at MIT
mm-hmm.
who came out with a scale, and according to her scale, to live comfortably. Now, okay, what does comfortably mean, right?
Yeah.
It was $75,000 a year. Mm. Now, I don't know. I'm not suggesting that minimum wage has to bring you a $75,000 a year job. But when you're only receiving even $17 an hour, you're not a whole lot ahead. You're not very, I'm having a hard time talking. That's just putting you just above the federal poverty line for an adult and one child. And yet we see this resistance to paying people something that at least keeps them well above the federal poverty line.
Right, right. Well, in answer to your question, a source that I really like to use is from the Ohio Association of Community Action Agencies. Right on their website, they have what they call a self-sufficiency calculator, and that's how much you need to make basic needs without assistance. And MIT has a similar one, but their incomes tend to be a little bit higher than the OACAA, so that's the one I tend to use. If you're a single adult in Franklin County, the self-sufficiency wage is $13.16 an hour, which translates to $27,716 annually full time. And it turns out that about 85% of Central Ohio jobs pay at least that much. The poverty income for that individual is $15,000, just over $15,000. As I say, poverty income is laughably below what you really need. You take that individual and you add a kid, a school-age kid, and what you're talking about now is $23.13 an hour, $48,857 annually full-time. And there are fewer than half the jobs in Central Ohio that pay that much. The poverty income for that household is $20,440. And a major cost there, I guess we can get into this a little bit, is child care. Child care can be north of $10,000 a year. There are subsidies for it, but the problem then becomes if your income starts going up at a certain point, you're going to hit that benefit cliff, you're going to drop off, and there goes your child care.
Well, the numbers you're giving me just off the top of my head tell me that then the minimum wage at whatever it was, $10.45 an hour, isn't really helping.
It's better than zero an hour, I guess. But what that $13.16 is saying is simply that you're going to need public assistance of one way or one sort or another. And unfortunately, the safety net has some holes.
As a small business owner, you know, obviously labor costs are a large portion of what we pay.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I understand the arguments that businesses make about government regulations, government telling us what to do. Is one of those arguments legit that it'll have the businesses will offshore this type of work? Is there offshore opportunities less than minimum wage? I mean, what country can you go to and pay them that much less for the same work?
China, but less so. Now it's more along the lines of Vietnam and other cities and or other countries in the Far East. To a certain extent, it may be Mexico, South America. But the problem with doing that, it's not a panacea in the sense that if you're offshoring your production, your supply lines and supply costs start going up. The risk of making things appear in the market when you need them to appear gets all that much larger. And we saw that in spades during the pandemic.
Let's go back to this idea of how business owners react to the idea of raising wages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you find too many business owners who think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will almost always cite increased cost means a loss of customers. And then you'll hear some economists say, well, there'll be some disruption, but in the long term, it'll all even out. And, you know, I'm not an economist, for goodness sake. I don't know how to square these opinions. Where do you come out on this battle about what bad things will possibly happen if wages are raised to a sufficient level where people can at least have a sustaining wage?
Well, the think tank Innovation Ohio once invited me to do an economic impact of raising the minimum wage in Ohio. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I suddenly just came to the point of just saying, I can't do this. It's too complex a question, because wages are driven by the value of their output. And so if, say, we raise the minimum wage to $16 an hour, and in that case, you really are talking about a fair number of jobs in Central Ohio that would be subject to this wage. The value of the work is the value of the output. And if the value of the output exceeds $16 an hour, then employers will grumble, but they'll pay the $16 an hour because they're better off paying at the knot. On the other hand, if the value of the output is less than $16 an hour, there you have a potential problem. And that's not just industry by industry or firm by firm, it's job by job. And that's why the question becomes so incredibly complex.
Well, it seems to take on more of a societal problem than an economic problem. Here's what I mean. When you say that the wage equals the value of the output, even to an economic dummy like me, I go, oh, okay, that makes sense. But here's the competing issue, which is I don't think there's any doubt about what it costs to just be self-sustaining, self-sustaining being above the federal poverty level, which also means you're not requiring assistance from Medicaid or supplemental nutrition, SNAP. It's called. So the value of the output might be X, but it might take Y to be able to be self-sustaining.
Yeah.
And businesses don't care about what it costs to be self-sustaining, but society should, I think.
Society certainly should. No doubt about it. Look at it this way. A middle income, a lower income household is going to spend every dollar that they take in. And here I'm completely leaving aside what the obligation of society to protecting its most vulnerable citizens. If you raise the wage of a low-wage worker, every dime that that worker makes is going to be spent. And so the income of households will increase, the consumption of households will increase, and so GDP will go up. Now, you might think, oh, that's going to raise prices. Well, maybe, maybe not, because not only is the demand increasing, the supply is increasing too. And so the final impact of all that on inflation is actually ambiguous. But here's a point. The profits of companies, large corporations, and what they pay their CEOs is really something to talk about. And here I draw from Robert Reich, who was labor secretary under Clinton. He's got a Substack that I follow like a hawk. It's tremendous. And a point that he likes to make is that in 1965, the typical CEO's pay was 20 times the pay of the typical worker. By 1979, it had gone up to 33 times the pay of the annual worker or average worker. And as of 2021, it was almost 400 times. So don't tell me that you can't pay a decent wage.
What accounts for that? Is it simply market forces? These people are perceived to be worth that type of wage to run a company? I mean, it just sounds so incredible.
Well, I think part of it, honestly, has to do with the increasing disparity between the power of large corporations and the power of workers. And that's in part a function of the decreasing power of unions.
I was going to say, you know, we have minimum wage laws. Maybe we need maximum wage laws.
Well, you simply tax them.
Well, that's unpopular.
It'll never pass.
No, of course not. Although we can certainly pass tax cuts. We've proven that. Mm-hmm. So here's the way I look at it. And, you know, I suppose some people are going to say that I probably hang a sickle and hammer flag outside my house. But it seems to be a top-down approach, mm-hmm. like the old trickle-down theory. And if I'm not mistaken, the trickle-down theory finally got debunked.
Oh, it keeps rising from the grave like a zombie every 10 or so years.
Yeah.
It's running around nowadays.
So what bothers me is that it is a top-down approach, as opposed to, and forgive me for sounding sort of new age, but there's not this holistic approach to how do we make the whole system work. Am I missing something there?
I don't think so. I think that what we're seeing now is the market forces forcing employers to pay more. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if in a few years that 400 times number didn't drop just a teeny tiny bit. The problem that we've got now is a demographic problem in the sense that there are more and more people my age, our age, and many of us are retiring. But there are lots of people who are, and there are fewer people coming in to replace them. And so if you look at the projections that the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission does of population by age in Central Ohio over the next decade, we're growing at less. The prime working age population, let me say it that way, is growing at less than 1% per year, about 0.6% per year. And if they're correct, that that growth is going to continue for the rest of the decade. We get a little bit better in the early 2030s. But at least for the time being, this slow growth is going to continue with us. And before the pandemic, I did a little simulation of the impact of a recession, a typical recession, on the labor shortage. And it is addressed. It's not solved during the recession. And when the recession is over, comes right back. So that, maybe more than a lot of other things, is going to lead to higher wages.
Well, yeah, as you were saying that, I was starting to be encouraged for people that are out there looking for jobs as us old people leave the marketplace and they're there, they're going to be more valuable. You know, I often think, though, of some of the most important employees of our society, like teachers.
Right.
And again, the people at the top make really good money.
You mean the people in administration, superintendents, et cetera?
Yeah. And if you think about higher education, you think about the football coaches at Ohio State, some of the most highly paid state workers in Ohio. I agree with you, Jack. It seems like the overall system is out of balance because there's not a guiding authority that can take into all aspects, right? I mean, the government does have a big role in it, but Bill, is there an overall authority that can take all the parts and harmonize them?
Well, there you're kind of talking about central command and control. Which sounds great in theory, but we've seen time and again that it doesn't work because the economy is simply too complex for anybody to manage effectively.
What happened to companies, and I'll use our law firm for an example, Jack.
Sure.
We want the best people working for us. Mm-hmm. And so we're willing to pay the wage that the best people in Columbus make at other firms. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that if we're talking about just pure profit, take Boeing, for example. All of a sudden, the quality of that company dropped considerably. And everything I'm reading is just because they've got the focus on profits and not upon quality. So what happened? Was there something that happened? Is it our generation that's kind of screwed things up here?
Well, I can't talk about Boeing specifically, but in general, it's minimizing wages, which are almost universally the most important center of cost. But the point is that if you hire less productive employees, you'll be able to hire them at a lower wage, but the quality and quantity of your output is going to suffer, and your profits may be lower than if you had spent that extra dime, as Boeing may at some point discover to their chagrin.
Yeah, it seems like that short-term gain is short-sighted,
it
too.
It is.
You know, I heard somebody, some authority, talking about Boeing having merged with McDonnell Douglas, and apparently it was the match of two different cultures, Boeing putting priority on engineering. Supposedly, McDonnell Douglas had more of a bottom line focus, And so the conjecture was, well, Boeing somehow absorbed more of that bottom line focus to its detriment. Who the heck knows?
Oh, it may be a generational thing, too. That was probably 5 or 6 CEOs ago. So yeah. Who knows?
Well, before we sign off, we've got a few more minutes. When we were downstairs, Bill, you were talking about how AI might enter the picture. Give us a few thoughts on that.
Well, at this point, no one really knows what artificial intelligence is going to wind up doing to the labor market, the workplace. But there are two forecasts out, one by the World Economic Forum, the other by McKinsey. And these came out a few years ago, so they may need to be updated. But the thinking was that that AI would replace fewer jobs than it would assist. The vast, vast majority of jobs are going to change fundamentally. But if AI becomes ready for prime time, and it's not entirely clear that it is quite yet, people will become more productive. And an interesting impact might be that the least productive people will see the greatest gains. And so there might actually be kind of a leveling of the field where if you're not especially productive, not especially skilled, AI might step in, help you do your job more effectively, and so your job would become more secure. But at this point, the jury's still out, to use a lawyerly phrase.
You know, I can see that in our profession. Just think about when we were in law school, to research, you had to go into the library, pull mm-hmm. books, and spend a whole day. And so yeah. If you, as a small firm, were up against a big firm, you're up against a dozen of their clerks or young lawyers in the library researching.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Lexis.
Yeah.
And online research. And all of a sudden, today,
boom.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need a library.
Yeah.
One person can sit down at a computer and do what a dozen law clerks were doing years ago. And I just have to imagine that AI is going to further that. Wouldn't you think, Jack? I mean, just there's so much information to assimilate.
Well, we've already seen that happen, I think. In fact, one law firm apparently used AI in a brief.
and the AI made cases up.
Yeah, it sort of created some case law that didn't exist.
Well, that's not unheard of before AI either, though, right? Yeah.
That's right. We just had human beings creating the case law, right?
I keep thinking about how I would run my business 30 years ago, even 20 years ago. I probably couldn't do it, not without a whole staff of people hanging out at the state library from 9 to 5 every day, looking stuff up, writing numbers down on legal pads and bringing it to me at the end of the day. I probably couldn't do it, or I'd have to charge my poor clients an arm and a leg.
Bill, economics is one of those things that's always been difficult for me to follow through, because there just seems to be so many variables that your professional people take into account, and my mind only expands so far to 1 or 2 or 3. But I appreciate your insights. I think we could talk about so many more aspects of the economy and society, so maybe we can get you back and do that sometime.
I'd love to. I'd love to.
I enjoyed it as well, Bill. Thank you so much. Our thanks to WOSU and our sound engineer, Dalton Jones. If you like what you've heard today, tell a friend. We want this to be more than just us. We want it to be all of us. We'll be back in another week or so with another social justice issue. Until then, so long.